Okay, I think we're all fired up and ready to go. A good blank screen there for you to meditate on. But we will have something on that screen in a few minutes here. What won't be on the screen will be scriptures today, so you will need your Bible. I'll have some other things on the screen as we go along. But I want to begin by going back to the feast and asking you a question. A lot of you were at different feast sites. The majority, I presume, was probably over at Orange Beach. But whatever feast sites you were at, what special music selection did you like the most at the feast this year? What special music selection? I'll let you think about it for a second or two here. At Orange Beach, we had a really, really nice choir at Orange Beach. It was huge compared to past years. The first time the choir was going to sing a selection, Mr. Sandilands was given the announcements, and the choir was lining up. And you know how those are there, you know how big that auditorium is. And so they were lined up from here, there, all the way to the back. And that partway through his announcements, he says, okay, the choir can begin coming up while he finished. And they started coming and coming and coming. And that line didn't, I don't know where it went, out inside into the outside area there or what. But they just kept coming. And they ended up with, I think, some 80-some people in the choir, something like that. Huge choir. They didn't have enough room on the choir risers for everybody. You know, they were crammed in and trying to fit them all in. So the stage was almost too small for all the choir. So it was a great choir, you know, not only in size, not only in quantity, but quality. And so the choir did several numbers of special music, but the choir was so big that on two occasions they broke the choir up and had only the men in the choir do special music, and then another day only the women in the choir did special music. So that was different. I hadn't seen that I don't know if I've ever seen that at the feast, but that was nice. And then, of course, there was the children's choir and different individuals and small groups and so forth. Every service, we had special music. And so I'd ask you, not just you, those who were there at Orange Beach, but those other ways, if you think, what did you like best of the selections at the feast? And one I enjoyed the most was the men's choir. I think probably because it was somewhat unique at the feast to have a men's choir. I don't remember exactly what they sung. I just remember it was very inspiring, and I really enjoyed it. And so that was what I thought was the best special music at the feast. But, you know, I dare say if we listed all the performances and asked everybody their individual opinion, I dare say that different ones of you who were at Orange Beach would have had a different opinion about what you found to be the most inspiring special music at the feast. I don't think we'd have a unanimous vote on any one selection that was, oh, this was it. This was the greatest. No, we all have our taste, our opinions, and so forth, and we see things differently when we judge things like music. Matter of fact, If I asked you what your favorite song of all times was, we'd probably get, I don't know, we've got 50 or so people here, we'd probably get 50 different answers for your favorite all-time song. And, you know, so we judge things differently. We judge quality differently. Sometimes things that you might think, I don't know about that. You know, look at go to an art museum. And some people might like this, and some people might like that. And, you know, there's this this qualitative assessment of things that varies a lot from individual to individual. And so what I want to do today is talk about how do you go about assessing yourself qualitatively. That's going to be the topic. If you want a title, measuring yourself when you can't put the numbers on it. You know, a lot of us like to put numbers on things. But there's a lot of things it's difficult to put numbers on, although we try. When we're assessing ourselves, we're looking at ourselves, how we're doing. I'm talking about, of course, how we're doing in terms of spiritual growth and that sort of thing. We're looking at ourselves. One way to assess ourselves, or in general, one way to assess things, is a quantitative assessment. Now, by quantitative assessment, it kind of basically means you can put some numbers on it. You know, you have a lot of big thing in sports these days is analytics. And basically, they're tracking so many different things in different sports, and they put numbers on it and so forth and come up with numbers that say, how good is this person versus how good is that person? They even have numbers in baseball, for example, replacement value. They can say, if you got rid of this guy and had to replace him, what's his value to the team in terms of replacing him with the average person from that position? Things like that. I mean, they put numbers on it. It's a quantitative type of analysis. And we can look at it from a religious perspective of obedience, disobedience, obeying God, following God. It would fall in this category of things that can be specifically determined. That would be quantitative type of assessment. Now, for example, thou shalt not murder. That's kind of a yes or no type of question, isn't it? Either murdered somebody or you haven't. You know, like I think I mentioned this at the feast. You never hear a person on trial for murder stand up and in his defense say, well, I kinda murdered him. It's kind of a yes or no question. You can put a number on it, you know, kind of thing. It's a definitive thing. Either you did or you didn't. And so, you know, some things are like that, but a lot of things are more qualitative in terms of assessment, where it's difficult to actually put a number on it. And so in terms of obedience or disobedience, these would be things that cannot be measured exactly. And I want to talk about some of those things as part of the sermon today. But, you know, there's something, you know, like just to throw out a couple examples, humility. Are you humble or are you not? That's a real sliding scale there. You can say, well, I'm kind of humble. Or, yeah, I'm really a humble person. You know, there's a scale there, and you just can't say yes or no. You know, it's a qualitative kind of assessment that's difficult to put numbers. Same thing with pain. I dare say that probably a third of this audience today is in some kind of pain right now, other than from listening to my sermon, that is. You know, backaches, headache, neck, knee, foot, you know, all these kind of things. Probably everybody's in some kind of pain, one way or the other, except all these young kids. They're never in pain about anything. But how do you assess the level of pain? Well, you know what doctors do. They come up with a pain measurement scale. Right? And so, you know, you go to a doctor and say, well, are you hurting? And you say, yeah, kinda. Oh, yeah, not too much. Oh, man, this really hurts. Oh, I'm dying here. You know, and you kind of give a qualitative assessment. And so the medical profession said, well, we need some numbers. And so they kind of put a scale of 0 to 10 in this case of how bad it is. And so they show you this kind of picture that we got here on the screen and say, well, just how bad is it? A little bit more, even more, a whole lot. And you see different descriptions of all these things. The worst ever imaginable pain up there at number 10. But what does the numbers mean? Give them a number. You know, I went in with my foot And then they showed the sign and said, okay, what it is. I said, maybe a 3. I don't know. Sometimes it's a 4 or 5. You know, I don't know how much pain it is. it's just a qualitative kind of assessment. And there's certain things are like that. Now, at the feast, I really apologize to this congregation who were at Orange Beach, because at the feast, I used a fair amount of material that I'd used in sermons here, and so that a lot of it wasn't new to y'all, because I was talking about values and the meaning of value-based living primarily, and I used some of that at the feast. And what I did is I talked about the Ten Commandments and talked about each of the commandments are not just a law, but there's values that behind the law. And, you know, the values are basically what God gave the laws for, not just the law, but certain values that the laws stand for. So that was what my sermon at the feast, and mainly focused towards education and how we'll teach and learn in the world tomorrow. But let's look at these commandments in terms of quantitative assessment versus qualitative assessment. And, of course, the first one, don't worship other gods. Isn't that kind of a yes-no thing, basically? Either you're worshiping other gods or you're not. You know, it's kind of like, you know when computers were first developed, basically it was a series of on-off switches. Zeros and ones. They still basically that, but zeros and ones. And so you put enough, the switches are aligned. This one's zero, this one's on, this one's off, that sort of thing. And that, it becomes a code. And so you could look at some of these commandments this way, is that they're basically either a yes or a no. That's pretty much quantitative. But behind it is some values, like service to God, as I've talked about here and did talk about the feast. And you go to the second commandment, don't worship idols. Again, either you do or you don't. You know, so in one sense, they're quantitative. And here's the thing. Practicing Christianity tends to look at the commandments pretty much solely from a quantitative view. They don't think about the values behind the commandments. They look at it pretty much from a quantitative view. Okay, yeah, I don't worship idols. I just worship one God. I go to church every Sunday and just worship God. You know, so they think, click, check that one off the list. You know, don't use profanity. Same kind of thing. Either you do or you don't. You know, now, of course, that value is respect for God. People don't think so much about that, and that's why people who claim to be religious quite often use quite a bit of profanity, don't they? But these are quantitative things, at least the way the world looks at them. These first three commandments kind of looked at it from a quantitative perspective. And somewhat's true on the fourth one, the Sabbath. You know, don't work on the Sabbath and keep it holy. And here we see there's a mixture, you might say, of a quantitative evaluation and a qualitative evaluation. Because, you know, again, the Sabbath, either you work on the Sabbath or you don't. You know, it's that kind of thing. That's pretty much quantitative. Yes or no. But keeping it holy, see, to do that, we'd now get into the realm of a qualitative evaluation or a qualitative assessment of what you're doing. And it's not a yes or no. Are you keeping, you know, today, have you kept the Sabbath holy today? You know, it's not exactly a yes or no question, is it? You have to say, well, what do you mean by, you have to start getting into what does holy mean? And, you know, I use the value of sanctification. We're sanctified because of the Sabbath. But it's not something you can just put a number on it or either answer yes or no. It's a judgment kind of thing. And so this is the first commandment that introduces, you might say, some value into the wording of the commandment itself. But then we come to honor your parents. which the value there is having respect for your parents, but here is the first commandment that is solely based on, following at least, is based on a qualitative assessment. How do you honor your parents? Do you honor your parents? Both my parents passed away some time ago. I can, in a sense, no longer honor them since they're not alive, although I guess I could by talking good or bad about them. But, you know, basically that box is kind of gone because they're not there for me to do something to, in the way of honoring them. But, you know, how do you define honor? For example, well, more about that in a minute, but let's go through the rest. Murder, pretty much a yes or no thing, although from a value point of view, as in Matthew 5, Christ talks about the reconciliation aspect of not hating, faith in God for your protection, and things of this nature. Don't commit adultery. You know, that's pretty much a yes or no kind of thing. Either you do or you don't, unless you're certain politicians who kind of want to debate whether they did or didn't and that sort of thing. But don't steal. Again, that's kind of a yes or no. You either steal or you don't. Don't lie. Again, a yes or no kind of thing, quantitative in terms. Although, you know, even professing Christians out in the world, they like to kind of hedge this one and say, well, little white lies don't count because that's for the good of the person that you're lying to. And so they try to put a little shade into that, but it's pretty much cut and dry. Either you lie or you don't. Boy, we're getting into the lying season now, aren't we? With Halloween, Christmas coming up, and all that kind of stuff. But then we come to number 10, don't covet. What's the line between coveting and not coveting? That's not a yes or no kind of thing, is it? That's a qualitative assessment. If you covet, you have to kind of, almost like pain. You know, how do you rate how much pain you're in? How do you evaluate how little coveting you do? And so, you know, all these commandments, at least the way the world views them in particular, are binary. They're either yes or no. You either do it or you don't, with the exception of honoring your father and mother and coveting. And then also with keeping the Sabbath holy, if we fall into that category. But let's go back and look at the business of honoring your parents and kind of assess, well, what does that mean exactly, and how do you do it? I want to turn over first, and here's where you'll need to get out your Bible, to Mark 7, beginning in verse 5. Mark 7 and verse 5. Then the Pharisees and the scribes ask him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands? All right, so here's the setup. They want to know, how come you're not following the traditions? And, of course, the Jews had all kinds of traditions. You know, they had the commandments, but that wasn't enough. So they wanted to quantify the commandments even more. You know, and so take the Sabbath. They wanted to say, okay, here's how far you can walk on the Sabbath and things like that. And so they had all these kind of judgments and these types of things that presumably filled in the gaps because God didn't give you enough information. And so these religious leaders did. And so they asked, well, how come you don't do it? This ceremonial washing is what they're talking about. And he answered and said to them, well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as is written, the people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain do they worship me, teaching the doctrines and commandments of men. For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men. the washing of pitchers and cups, and many other such things that you do. He said to them, verse 9, all too well, you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your tradition. You know, so here's the, you might say, this first part kind of sets up the situation. They want to know, hey, how come you're not following all our traditions? That's a sin. It's basically what they're saying. That's what they're accusing him of. And so that's kind of the setup. Now, Christ has to respond to this, and of course, he begins his response by really hitting them hard. But then, as we go to verse 10, look what commandment he picks to discuss this issue further with. He goes to the commandment about honoring your parents. So in verse 10, for Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses his father or mother, let him be put to death. So he quotes two things here. He quotes the commandment. He quotes the fifth commandment. But then he quotes Exodus 21:17, where he's saying, basically, that's a judgment that came after the commandments, a couple, you know, after the Ten Commandments, all these statutes, laws, judgments, and all were given. And one was, if a person curses his parents, you stone him, you kill him. Pretty severe then. But you certainly got the message. And again, that was kind of an on-off thing. Well, you either curse or you don't. So you're going to die or live, you know, depending on that sort of thing. It's all kind of quantitative there in terms of the judgment. But then verse 11, he says, but you say, if a man says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is Corban, that is, a gift to God, then you no longer let him do anything for his father or his mother, making the word of God of no effect through your traditions, which you have handed down, and many such things that you do. So, you know, we don't know exactly the details from history of what this... Back then, all these judgments, it was still oral. It was oral history. Rather than write, it was just centuries later that they began to write down a lot of these things. But apparently the scholars have concluded, at least in this sense, that if a person, instead of helping a parent that was in need, said this money is set aside for God, that apparently they didn't give it to God, but it was set aside for God. And maybe they would give it later, maybe not. It seemed to be that kind of thing that was the part of the tradition that had evolved. And so, but the key point here is that what was going on? The religious leaders were hoping they would end up with more money. And to the effect of pushing people into dishonoring their parents, even. You know, so that was what he was getting at there. And let's go to verse 14. when he had called all the multitude to himself, he said to them, "Hear me, everyone, and understand. There is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him, but things which come out of him, those are the things that defile him. If anyone has ears, let him hear. Let him hear." Verse 17. So he makes this statement about what defiles a person, and but remember the original question here was about eating bread without washing your hands. So, it had to do with eating. And so he said, you're focusing on the wrong stuff here. Verse 17, when he had entered the house away from the crowd, his disciples asked him concerning the parable. And so he said to them, because they were probably thinking, does this mean that food is there's no unclean food? That's probably what they were thinking. Is that what he's saying? So he said to them, "Are you thus without understanding? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile. Another way to that word is profane. Cannot profane him because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying the foods. But what comes out of a man that defiles him? For within, out of his heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murder, theft, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within a man and defile a man. Okay, so he composes a list here. He composes a list here of things that defile. And take a look at the list here, beginning in verse 21. Adulteries. Okay, so he's talking about the seventh commandment. Murders, sixth commandment. Theft, eighth commandment. Covetousness, tenth commandment. But then these others, like fornication, wickedness, lewdness, evil eye, pride, foolishness. Those aren't exactly commandments, are they? You know, they get away from the specific. You know, deceit. You know, that's basically lying. So that's the ninth commandment. Blasphemy, which is mentioned here, that's basically violating any of the first four commandments. It's blasphemy. You know, so he's intermixed aspects of keeping the commandments with other things here that is on a broader scale. You know, how do you measure such things as wickedness, pride? Are you sinning because of pride? You know, where's the line? Where do you draw the line between just being confident in yourself and being proud? Where is that line? How do you decide that? You know, it's what we really want to do is we'd like to draw a scale from 1 to 10. How well do you honor your parents? Isn't that what we'd like? If we could just put it on a scale, like from 1 to 10. Now, let's see. Oh, I look back on my life. I think I probably hit about a 7. But that's not what we really want to know. What we really want to know is where the break point is, right? If the break point is 8 and I only made a 7, I'm in big trouble here, right? And so we'd really like to know, where does God draw the line? In other words, we want to quantify something that involves quality, qualifying type of assessment rather than a quantifying type of assessment. You see what I'm talking about there? You know, so we can talk about the, you know, revile on one end, treating with distinction on the other end. But I would say probably all of us are somewhere in between. But where? And where does God expect you to be? What's God's magic number on honoring your parents, for example? And it may not be one number, if it's a number at all. For example, some parents may need more honoring than others. So it may be a kind of an individual thing. Yeah, maybe you've had parents that you know, once you've left home, for example, and out on your own, they have their own lives and they're doing things. They're happy. They're traveling. They're doing this, and you don't see them so much. Does that mean you're dishonoring them? No, they're happy. They'll see you and visit and so forth. But then there may be a situation where your parents are sick, elderly, maybe not far from death, and so they need a lot more time, a lot more attention under those scenarios. So that line of the amount of time and effort you spend might move up and down the scale, might it not? But we like to try to put numbers on something that is very difficult to put numbers on, because We're talking about a qualitative assessment, not a quantitative assessment. So we can ask, where do you fit on the scale? But that's probably not the real question that needs to be asked. But let's go to something else here. Let's go to to Luke 12 and verse 13. So I want to get into covetousness here. That's the other command. We talked about the fifth commandment, honor. The other one that is not a yes or no kind of thing is covetousness. So I want to look at that in Luke 12 and verse 13. Then one of the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Okay, so here's the setup, and he says to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" You know, so if there's the question, and so how does he answer it? He brings up the 10th commandment, covetousness. And he said to them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." Okay, so he warns about violating the 10th commandment. Watch out for it. That's basically what he said. Then he gives the parable. Then he spoke the parable in verse 16, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully, and he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no more room to store my crops?'" Well, that's a good situation to be in. You got such a healthy harvest, you can't store it all. He had the solution, so he said, "I will do this. I'll pull down my barns, I'll build greater, and then I'll store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" You know, so that's the way Christ frames the situation. Of course, it's a parable. But remember, you know, what he's talking about here. He's talking about coveting. That's the subject matter here. And he points to this person, he uses this parable, and he uses this phrase, and he says, "Okay, now I'm going to eat, drink, and be merry." That phrase appears in another place in the Bible. We're not going to turn to it, but you probably remember at least the book it appears in, Ecclesiastes. While Solomon talks about trying everything to learn and so forth, and one of those things was to eat, drink, and be merry. Now, so he uses this same thing from Ecclesiastes, which points out that there's something going on here other than just, you know, living a good life. He's going beyond that. And so, you know, that's where coveting leads to, is one of the points here. But going on in verse 20, "But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will these things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God.'" And so what he's saying here is you're focusing on the wrong thing here. You need to be focusing on values. What does coveting really mean? How do you find it? How do you know when you're coveting or not? He said you've got to be focusing on something here. And interestingly enough, there's some other scriptures I want to look at here. Romans 7 and verse 7 that relate to this. Romans 7 and verse 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law, for I would not have known covetousness unless the law said, you shall not covet. All right, now, so here, you know, Paul appears to see coveting as one of the keys to unlocking the law. You know, he's talking about the law. This whole chapter is talking about the law. He talks a lot about the law in Romans. But he specifically gets into the area of the 10th commandment here, coveting. The one of the two that you can't quantify very easily. And so he says, I would not have known covetousness unless the law said you shall not covet. But in verse 8, but sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil thoughts. For apart from the law, sin is dead. In other words, he's saying, there's no sin if you don't know, if you never heard of the law. There's no sin. But he goes on to say, I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. Now, what is Paul saying here? What is Paul saying here in verse 9? I want us to focus on this for a minute. When was Paul ever outside the law? From the perspective of the commandments. Keep your place your place here, but let's look at Philippians 3 and verse 4. I'm going to turn over to Philippians 3 and verse 4, but hold your place where we are. We're going to come back there. Philippians 3 and verse 4. Paul is writing here, and we're breaking into the middle of a sentence. Though I also might have confidence in the flesh, if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. See, in other words, you think you can obey the law? You think you can do the law? You know, the yes-no kind of things. I can do it better. Circumcised on the eighth day of the stock of Israel by the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. He wasn't just a Hebrew. He was a Hebrew of Hebrews. Concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning righteousness, which is in the law, blameless. He was blameless in the law. That's what he's saying here. Before he was converted. So going back to Romans 7 and verse 9. Now, with that in mind, what Paul said, he could follow the letter of the law. Boy, could he follow the letter of the law. Where did it lead him? It led him to join up with a bunch of guys that were killing Christians. He became part of the team that was killing Christians. That's where it led him. And so when he says, I was once alive without the law, he wasn't talking about the letter of the law. Because he was always in the letter of the law. He met that quantitative aspect. At least he thought he was meeting it. But when the commandment came, he came to understand the values associated with the commandments, that it was not just a yes-no kind of thing, but it was values. It was a quality kind of thing, not a quantity kind of thing. Then sin revived and he died. What died? What dies in all of us when we've come to see who we really are? The old man, does it not? The old man dies and we're baptized and a new man comes out of that water. A man that looks at everything differently. That old man dies spiritually. A new, spiritually alive person comes out of that water. In verse 10, and the commandment which was to bring life, I found brought death, you know, just following the law, didn't do it. It had to be more than just the letter of the law is what he's saying here. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. You know, so see, obeying the letter of the law led Paul to murder. You know, maybe didn't do it physically himself, but he was arresting people, sending them to jail. He was causing people's deaths. You know, it led him to what he was thinking. He was obeying the commandments. It led him to do just the opposite. Therefore, the law, in verse 12, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good. So now he's seeing the law from an entirely different perspective. See, he's quit trying to quantify the law, and is looking from the qualifying, you know, the quality of the law, not just quantities, is what he's doing. And he saw, and he uses the tenth commandment here as his departure point in this discussion, you know, because he saw the tenth commandment as one that was expressing values only. There was no yes or no there in coveting. It was a sliding kind of thing that you can't quite ever put a number on. But it's also a commandment that opens the door to the values behind all of the other laws. You know, what when people start coveting, what do they do? Typically, don't they lie? Don't they steal? Sometimes, even murder. Commit adultery. Doesn't it lead to all those kind of things? Isn't that what we see so much of in today's society? You know, it's kind of the door that opens things up so that you end up violating all the other laws. Paul thought he was obeying the law, like arresting Christians, persecuting them. He thought that. Let's look at another scripture related to this, Colossians 3 in verses 1 through 5. Colossians 3, verse 1. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting on the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things of the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Yeah, the old man died. Same thing Paul was saying earlier. He's repeating here. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth. And then he lists a bunch of sins again. Goes through a list here. Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So he goes through a list again, and there is coveting shows up again in this list. And notice what he says about covetousness. It's idolatry. Violates another commandment. This whole thing of coveting just points to all the different commandments and puts you in jeopardy, in danger of violating all these commandments. And, you know, all but one on this list, you could say, is qualitative. You know, all but one of these things is, fornication, maybe not so. You know, it's either a yes or no kind of thing, you do or you don't. All these other things, you can't say yes or no. It's to degrees. Let's look at 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. 2 Peter 2 and verse 1. But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. How? By covetousness. They will exploit you with deceptive words for a long time. Their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. Now, coveting is going to be the key tool that people will use to exploit you, the false prophets. That's where it's going to come from. It's going to come from that. Yeah. You look back at the modern history of the Church of God, you know, the split at the end of the worldwide days, for example. You know, what was going on there? What was being sold then? You don't have to do anything. You don't have to obey the laws. You just have to be good. You don't have to tithe. I always liked that one. You don't have to tithe. And they said, now you'll be able to give more than 10%. I don't think it worked out that way for them. But you see where that was coming from? They were leading them into coveting. Oh boy, this is going to be better for me. That's what happens with false teachers. And that coveting is the key tool to exploit you. Let's look at Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? And that kind of sums up coveting right there. Kind of sums it up, doesn't it? Basically, what Paul is saying there, if you're going to either trust in your others, trust in yourself, or you're going to trust in God. And the thing that you have to watch out for is coveting. One of those commandments which from the very beginning was not a yes-no sort of thing, but a sliding scale. So what about that sliding scale? I'll put a sliding scale back up here. From 1 to 10, how are you doing on the coveting aspect of obeying the law? From selfish to selfless, how are you doing? Let me ask you this. Some of you are still in school. Most of you are not. But when you were in school, if you're not still in school, what kind of test did you hate the most? What kind of test did you hate the most? Did you hate a true or false test the most? No. I kind of like those true and false tests. You know, I'm kind of an analytical person. That's why I went into engineering. I said, I really haven't studied too much for this thing. But it's true or false. And I probably can, just from being in class, probably get maybe 70% of it. So then at least 30. So even if I just put all true on the rest, that's probably going to get about half of those. That's going to pull that 70 up to an 85. So, hey, I'm up in the B's here. So, I like those true or false tests. How about multiple choice? They're not too bad. Now, you know the answer's there, right? But then I noticed as I went through school, teachers started getting smarter when they gave multiple choice tests. And they said, for the last two, all of the above or none of the above. Yeah, that made it a little hard, but it was kind of a quantitative thing. You know, it's one of those answers. How about fill in the blank? That was a little harder. You had to come up with the word. but still not too bad. But the one I really hated was the essay test. Yeah, I see him. I see a few nods here. The essay test. And a kind of question like, evaluate the effect of the Taft-Hartley Act on the history of America from its inception to the present time, explaining the pros and cons and where it's worked and hasn't worked. Huh? Oh, I did not like essay questions. If you can't put numbers on it, I didn't like it. And so we like to put numbers on things. You know, I like covetousness. Now, where do you fit on the scale? Now, what is kind of interesting to me, I think God, what in one sense, wants to really see, he wants you to decide where you need to be on the scale, maybe. You know, he wants to see what your thinking is. Where's your goal here on this scale? Are you really satisfied with a 5, a 7? Or is that goal a 10? Which brings me to this question. Multiple choice test here. Will you be in God's kingdom? Check one of the boxes. Yeah, we're kind of quantitative here now, almost. Will you be in God's kingdom? Suppose the answer is no. Suppose you say no. I'm not going to make God's kingdom. I have had such a wretched life. I have made so many mistakes. I have hurt so many people. I don't think I'm going to make it. I just done too much in my life. Now, if that's the mindset you have, you need to sit down and do some heavy-duty counseling, Mr. Sanderlands, because you don't really understand the principle of repentance and forgiveness. And so if the answer is no, you don't really understand some things you need to understand. I suppose you check yes. I'm going to be in that kingdom. Kind of reminds me, you don't see this much anymore, but years ago when I was living in Starkville, Mississippi, a couple of guys came to the house, and these weren't Jehovah's Witnesses type. They were just some local church, Baptist or whatever. And they were visiting the neighborhood, and we were kind of new in the neighborhood. And so they came in, and basically what they wanted to know was, am I saved? Have I been saved? Yeah. You ever been asked that question, are you saved? If you say no, then you say, well, let me tell you. And if you ask them, they say, yes, I'm saved. You ask them that question back. And this is kind of like this. If you say yes, you say, that's it. I'm going to be in God's kingdom. It's guaranteed. Is it? You know, that's what a lot of people believe. A lot of people believe that all you have to do is accept Christ as your Savior. And that's it. You're in the kingdom. You're going to be there. Well, that could be a little bit dangerous. So what about maybe? What about maybe? Would that be a better answer? You know, what are we trying to do? As individuals, what are we trying to accomplish? Sure, we want to be in God's kingdom. Sure, we know that Christ's sacrifice did away with our past sins and opened the door to allow us to eventually walk through. But what are we doing Do we just now, can we just kick back and relax? Kind of just make sure, yeah, we don't kill anybody. Don't lie. Let's don't steal anything. You know, let's just check, click off the boxes. Yes, 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 no, no, no. Click off the boxes and just sit back and say, ah, okay. I'm here. I'm ready. Bring on the kingdom. Is that what it is? Is that what it is? I want to close with one final scripture here. It's over in Luke 13:24. In Luke 13:24. Somebody came up and, well, in verse 23, we might look there. Then one said to him, Lord, are there few who are saved? And what did he say? All you got to do is believe in me, and you've got it made. Notice what he said here. Strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able. But here I want you to focus on one word of what he said here. Strive. Strive. You know, I've been talking about these scales. Where are you on the cut of this scale? Maybe you're down there at the 4. And God's number is 7. Oh, you've had it. But is that what God's looking for? Or wherever you are you striving to move up the scale? You know, we come into the church with all kinds of baggage. Some of us are so loaded down it's crushing us. Some of us kind of skipping in, la-da-da, not too much baggage. Good life so far, but now I see God's calling me. You know, we come in with some's are here, some's there, some, you know, we're all kinds of backgrounds and so forth, all kinds of baggage. And somebody comes in, maybe they're a 1. But they're striving. And they're striving, and maybe they finally make it to a 5 and they die. But the magic number was 7. Too bad. Gonna burn in hell. That's it. Third resurrection for you. See, God is looking at not quantity, but quality. How much are you striving? Those of you who are striving, and that's a word that says something. It doesn't say those of you, oh, I'm trying. I'm kind of moving along. I'm learning. I'm kind of understanding. Striving. I wish I could say it like Mr. Roy. Striving is the way he would say it. You know, that's what God's looking for. He's not looking at the number. But he wants you to understand that we're talking not about yes, no, on, off. We're talking about values that you need to be striving for with all your might. Are you striving to be in God's kingdom?